afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our full year 2017 results. A warm welcome to those of you on the telephone, a warm welcome to those of you on the webcast, and of course, welcome to those of you here in the room in London. There will be, as always, a Q&A session at the end of the presentation, and we'll be happy to take questions from the phone or from those of you on the webcast. Just follow the instructions you've been given. Of course, we will, as usual, give preference to questions coming from those of you here in the room. Here on the stage, we're joined by our CEO, Thomas Buberl, our Deputy CEO and CFO, Gerald Haller. In the room, we also have our CEO for France, Jacques Duperrey, our CEO for AXA in Europe, Antimo Perretta, and our CEO for the U.K. and Ireland, Amanda Blanc. Welcome to you all as well. Without further ado, it's now my pleasure to hand over to Thomas.
Thank you, Andrew, and good afternoon to all of you. I'm extremely happy to be with you this afternoon, particularly in view of the very good results that we have presented this morning. When we look at the key takeaways of the results, I would like to stress five points. The first one is, you have seen that we have published excellent results. This is a very strong earnings growth relative to last year, which has led the board of AXA SA to decide that the dividend will increase. The second important message is, if you look, where does the growth in earnings come from? It is not from one geography or from one operation. It is across the board from all geographies that have contributed to this excellent performance. The third one is, many of you might say, well, on the revenue side, you have been flat, but this was a very dedicated and clear decision to focus ourselves on more profitable new business and to deprioritize business that is not profitable enough. This focus has really driven those strong results that we have published today. All of this has happened and will happen in the future on a very strong and reliable balance sheet. You have seen that our Solvency II ratio has again been reinforced, and this is also a very good basis for a very strong cash generation in the group. For the first time, we have also published health separately. I know this was a big desire of yours, of some of yours, over a long time. We have done it because health for us is very important. It is a big ground for innovation. We have certainly moved on with some very tangible results. Health is not only a question on the insurance side and innovation side, it is also a question on how are we behaving as a social actor when it comes to investing. Also on the social acting side and being a responsible citizen, we have taken some very clear measures when it comes to our investment focus and sustainability. If I start with Ambition 2020. In June 2016, we have launched Ambition 2020. Four major targets were attached to this objective, these objectives of Ambition 2020. The first one was underlying earnings per share. We said our ambition is, despite the fact that we have a negative impact from capital markets, we want to achieve an underlying earnings per share growth between 3% and 7%. In 2017, we have hit the absolute top of this range with +7%. A second important target was the free cash flow. We set ourselves the objective based on a remittance ratio that is quite high to get to a cash generation capabilities over the period of 2016 to 2020 of 28 billion-32 billion. 2017 has been a year of a generation of 6.3 billion. Again, well in line within the target range that we have set ourselves. On the adjusted return on equity, we set ourselves a target between 12% and 14%. And in 2017, we have even overreached this range with 14.5%. On the solvency side, I commented earlier on it, we have a target range between 170 and 230. We are spot on in the middle, slightly above the middle, with a very proud 205%, which is an increase compared to last year. When we look at the underlying earnings, we can see a strong growth of 7.5%, which has led to an underlying earnings per share growth of 7.3%, right at the top of the range that I indicated just earlier. On the adjusted earnings and the net income, we see a very similar tendency for the first time, 7.6% on the adjusted earnings and 8.5% on the net income. 6.2 billion on the net income is also the first time that we have surpassed the threshold of 6 billion in the history of AXA. When we look at the adjusted earnings per share, which is the base for the dividend, we can report 7.6% growth, and this has obviously led to the decision of the board of AXA to say we want to increase the dividend. We want to increase it from 116 to 126, while at the same time increasing our payout ratio from 48 to 49%. With those 49%, we are still in the guidance range of 45 to 55%. I said earlier that this result has been fueled by a very good performance across all the geographies that AXA has. And maybe you notice here that we have for the first time now changed our reporting from a line of business reporting to a geography reporting. This goes very much with the simplification of our organization. Last year in November, on the 14th of November, we have announced that we have changed our organization away from a very complex regional and line of business organization to an extremely simple organization that is based on geographies. When you look at those geographies, you can see that France, which is our stronghold, which makes roughly 20% of our overall result, is a very strong contributor to the overall results. We are a strong market leader in France. We are in the top three everywhere. And despite the fact that we are big, we are still gaining market share. Why is that the case? Jacques and his team is extremely innovative, is extremely well positioned when it comes to product innovation, when it comes to distribution, and they can really reap the benefit of this great positioning. The same is true when you look outside of France into Europe. Again, Europe with 2.3 billion underlying earnings is a very strong contributor, has grown by 2%, and when you look across these markets, you see that AXA has extremely strong positions. Number one in Belgium, number one in Switzerland, number five in Germany, very strong in the UK when it comes to health and commercial line, number two in health, so very strong positions. These have helped us to really grow, to really improve, and also to make sure that the business mix has shifted in the right direction. We've often heard about the fact that Europe is not so strong and that the emerging markets bring all the new profitability. If you look at our experience, this is not true. Europe is strong, Europe is alive, and we are also happy that the core of AXA is alive and brings good results. Nevertheless, outside of Europe, we also have two other strong footholds that are very important for us. One is the US. In the US, we have a very strong position in the retirement space, in the teacher segment, and also in the asset management with AllianceBernstein. The US has experienced a very positive year with plus 16% of underlying earnings, where it's really a great story. When we look into Asia, we also have a very unique positioning. We are the only company that is a multi-line insurer there. We are the only company that plays in the bancassurance and the agent channel, a very strong positioning where we have really focused on fewer countries to really fuel the growth there. There, we clearly need to continue working on our business mix, continue working on our growth. I would have loved to see more growth there in 2017. On the international businesses, which is all the other countries, we have also realized a significant improvement in the underlying earnings growth of 20%. Those are the markets of tomorrow, but those are also the markets that we need to streamline and need to decide where are we staying in and where are we going out. And you have seen that we mean it. Yesterday we have announced one disposal in Azerbaijan, and we will continue working on those portfolios to manage the profits and manage them for profit, but also to rationalize our footprint. When we look at the business mix, I'm extremely proud that we have continued to optimize our business mix. And despite the fact that some of you in this room have said, look, at 40% NBV margin, it's over, more is not possible, we have seen that we have proven the opposite. We have gone from 40 to 43.1, again with a further shift towards protection, towards health, and towards unit linked. This obviously has a consequence on the growth, because if you focus yourself on one area and more or less exclude other growth areas, it does show in the growth, but that doesn't matter. We need to continue this journey, and we need to really make sure that despite rising interest rates, we stay disciplined and we show an improvement year after year. When we look into the profitability of the other lines of business, P&C, protection and health, we can also see that our strong discipline in driving profitability has clearly shown in the combined ratios. We have worked hard on improving our loss ratios. We have been very disciplined, and Gerald will show that to you in a few minutes, on the question of how is our reserving, how is our prior year experience. We've been very clearly at the lower end. As I said earlier, health for the first time is fully separated. Health for us is a very strategic segment. We are the leader in health. We are very strong in 6 markets. And these 12 billion of revenues have grown at 6%, which is a remarkable figure. At the same time, the underlying earnings have grown by 11%. And we have continued to invest and to realize and build up our innovative scales. I would like to mention 2 important pieces. One is the acquisition of Maestro Health in the US. Maestro Health is a population health management company, so they are not an insurance company in the primary space, but they are a service company to help in particular companies to reduce their medical expenses. And I was very pleased to see that after we have realized that purchase, that 3 large US institutions have put themselves together to make sure that they work on exactly that topic. That has shown to me that we are on the right journey. The second element, which is not on the slide, but I'm also very proud of that, is that we have now, over 2 years, ramped up our telemedicine operations in various countries. Today I can report back to you that 10 million beneficiaries have access to that telemedicine, so it's really something very different. It is something that is very convenient for the customers, because in the first instance, with the first call, we can resolve 70% of the issues. And these are the first steps, among many others that I can't talk about now because we have no time, that we are making from really moving from a payer to a partner. As a very large investor, we also have to ask ourselves the questions, what can we do to help society to live a better life? And what can we also do to influence the claims behavior that we're experiencing in a positive way? And clearly, you have seen we have a long track record of being very focused as a responsible and sustainable insurer, being focused on climate change, being focused on really providing people with a healthy life. We have started divesting from coal. We have then divested from tobacco, and we have taken a further step from divesting from coal. On the one hand, increasing our investments in green areas, 12 billion, which is four times more than what we had previously. Additionally, divesting 3 billion from coal and not insuring any new production of coal. This is for us an absolutely core element because our mission is how do we empower people to live a better life? This goes with paying claims. This goes with helping people in their daily lives without having claims, but that also goes with investing in a responsible way. If I come back to Ambition 2020, I'm again very proud of these results. All of the KPIs that we have published this year are either in the range or at the top of the range, with 7% underlying earnings per share at the top of the range, 6.3 billion of free cash, 14.5% return on equity above our target range, and an extremely solid balance sheet of 205%, 8% more coverage than last year. I would now like to hand over to Gérald, who goes into more detail. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. Underlying earnings, in line with our new format, but you will see later on that we have some reconciliations. What you can see is that, as explained by Thomas, we have an underlying earnings which is up 7%, and you can see that all the markets are up across the board. Let's start with, and let's go through all these markets, and let's start first with France. In France, we have underlying earnings going up by 3%, explained by higher unit-linked fees in line with the market improvement, an improved loss ratio in protection, improved claims experience in P&C commercial lines, and this is offset by lower investment income, and you will see that across the board in most our markets, we have lower investment income in line with our expectation. Also, we have higher acquisition expenses, but it's quite normal because it concerns health and protection where we have strong top-line growth. Next, on the top right, you can notice the high profitability of our business in France, and you will see that we can make exactly the same remark as far as Europe is concerned. P&C combined ratio 94.6, NBV margin 34.5, plus 3 points. Revenues plus 4% when we exclude a large pension contract at the end of 2016, with 14% in health, 13% growth in unit-linked. Next is Europe, and in Europe, it's almost the same story. Underlying earnings plus 2, explained by higher technical margin, notably in Belgium and Germany, lower expenses because maybe you remember that in 2016, we had an extraordinary amortization of our VBI in Switzerland, and we have a negative coming from lower investment margins. High profitable business, P&C 94.6% combined ratio, NBV margin even stronger than in France, 56.6% plus 8 points. Look at the bottom right, 84% of our revenues are in P&C health and protection, absolutely in line with our strategy, which consists in being less dependent from the financial market because the technical margin, as you know, are decorrelated from the financial markets. minus 1% in revenues, mostly explained by the GA savings, and the minus 23 in GA savings, it's mostly first in Italy, because in Italy we have revenues down 12%, with, I should insist, a strong recovery in the second part of the year in Italy, thanks to MPS. You know that MPS had problems and difficulties in the first half of the year, but we have a strong recovery with most of a significant part of this new business done in unit-linked business, which explains also the plus 30% that you can see here. Next is Asia, and Asia underlying earnings are up 7%. I would say that it's explained by two main elements. First, improved technical profitability across the board among all the countries, and second, lower expenses, and that's mostly in Japan. Here again, just have a look at the combined ratio for health, 78.3%, NBV margin 70.6 plus 6 points, and again, look at the on the bottom right, at the bottom right, the circle, 86% of our production, of our revenue, sorry, are in P&C, health and protection. 1% economic revenues. In Japan, we were at minus 6%. Why? Because we had the drop in the bank insurance business, which was mostly GA type, general account type of business, with whole life business, single premium whole life business. Why? Because there is a new regulation, and I mentioned it already for the first half, that imposed the banks to disclose their commissions, and it slowed down the new business. In Hong Kong, plus 2%, it's also due to a change in the regulation, as you know, with the decrease in limited commission in unit-linked business, which again slowed down the Hong Kong business, but plus 11% in high potential, which is quite good. Moving now to the United States, plus 16%. So United States, it's as mentioned by Thomas just before, it's our life business plus the asset management business of ABE. So here we could say that underlying earnings are growing significantly, plus 16%. Explained by improved financial market conditions with higher unit-linked fees, with higher GMXB margin, technical margin, and higher management fees at AB. This is offset by unfavorable mortality experience and net unfavorable model updates. So APE plus 6% with a strong momentum, especially in higher sales in mutual funds, NBV margin plus 23.4, plus 2 points, and this most of these 2 points improvement correspond to the tax effect, because it's a net present value of future profit, and tax, as you know, will drop in the US, explaining most of the 2 points improvement. Net inflows plus 12 billion, and management fees plus 2.7 billion, and it's a good news, meaning that for an asset management company, a lot of asset management companies today are suffering from decrease in their management fees. It's even the contrary here at AB, because they are moving towards a higher proportion of retail business versus institutional business, explaining this improvement in the management fees. International, it's a smaller market. 337 million euros of underlying earnings, but UE increasing by 20%, with higher investment and technical profit in Turkey. Turkey is back in black, and it was not the case last year. We have a current year combined ratio which is now close to slightly below 99%, which is good. And as you know, we have investment income which are quite high in Turkey, around 8%. Improved technical margin as well in Russia. And these two good elements, positive elements, are offset by NatCat charges in Mexico and Turkey. You can notice that revenues are up 2%, and excluding Turkey, I remind you, and we mentioned it for the first half, that in April 17, we have been imposed a 30% drop in prices in TPL, in third-party liability. So it's not the biggest business line in Turkey, but nevertheless, we suffered from this element. But it's progressively improving because we have the capacity to increase our prices by 1.5% per month. Next is the AXA IM, just to finish this review. Underlying earnings plus 16%. Reasons for these improvements are not very different from AB. Higher management fees, improved cost-to-income ratio, and as you can see, good level of net inflows, 8 billion, and of which 9 billion in third party, and cost-to-income ratio going down from 70.2 to 70.8, meaning that in the end, we have an improved operational leverage. So I presented all these markets except transversal and central holdings because in this category, in this bucket, we have, which grows by 8%, we have AXA IM, I presented it already, plus 16%, but we have also AXA Corporate Solutions, which is a large risk company. Unfortunately, underlying earnings of ACS went down by 59% linked to the weather events and to the Nat Cat. And we have also AXA SA, and AXA SA had an improvement, and this improvement is linked to the 3% tax, because you know that previously we had a 3% tax on dividends, and starting from 17, we don't have this tax anymore, and you will see later in the presentation that net income will benefit from the reimbursement of the last years of this 3% tax. Adjusted earnings, explained mostly by plus 8% underlying earnings, and also we have these capital gains, mostly in equities, 674. You can see that net impairments are significantly down compared to last year. The markets are quite good, and this improvement translates into lower impairments. That's for adjusted earnings. Now, net income. Net income benefits from this 8% improvement in adjusted earnings. And we have the different elements, starting first with this mark-to-market of derivatives, minus 357. It's mostly these derivatives who don't benefit from the hedge accounting. And we have also the change in fair value of assets, which are mostly mutual funds, which are not consolidated, and as a consequence, they are marked to market. This is due to the tightening of spreads, which explains the 222. So minus 134. Then we have the exceptional and discontinued operations, 124. I should give you four elements because we have a lot of big amounts offsetting each other. First, the US DTL. That means that, as you know, we have a net DTL position in the US under IFRS, which means that the drop in the tax rates makes that it was a good guy. 288 million from this coming from this US DTL decrease. On the reverse, in France, we have a net DTL position, which means that it was a negative from 191. And we have this refund of the 3% dividends that I mentioned before. It's a plus 249. Unfortunately, this has been offset by another element, which means that we are managing some annuities in France, and part of the indexation previously was paid by the state. We are referring to very old annuities dating from 60 years ago, and a good way for the French state to repay the refund of 3% was to stop paying this subsidy on annuities. which means that for us it's a negative of 206, which means that more or less in France, unfortunately, it was a wash. So, as a whole, nevertheless, after all these elements, we have integration restructuring costs. You remember that last year we had significant restructuring costs coming from Germany, from Belgium. Now we are at minus 148, pretty in line with the usual rate. So, as a whole, net income is at plus 8%. Now, moving to the underlying by business line, I would say the old format. And you can see that, as a whole, we have plus six billion of underlying earnings, plus 7%. Looking and focusing on life and savings, it's plus 9%, with, I would say, higher management fees offset by lower investment margin. In P&C, minus 1% at 2.4 billion, with lower investment margin, but also some nat cat, meaning that in the end we are at minus 1. Strong growth in health coming from the top line as well as an improvement in the technical margin. And asset management, plus 32% at 540 million, explained by higher management fees and also the operational leverage, i.e. the cost-to-income ratio going down. Let's move to this traditional slide. This one didn't change combined ratio. So you can see on the left that we have a current year combined ratio going down by 0.1 points. Excluding the natural catastrophes, it went down by 0.3. You can notice that we have prior year reserve developments at 1.2, minus 1.2% versus minus 1.3%. So we continue to take a prudent approach, and you'll get more details. Maybe you'll have questions in the AFR report. And all year combined ratio moves down from 96.4 to 96.3. Let's move to the cost savings. We are on track. We achieved 0.5 billion after 0.3 billion 1 year ago. As a whole, we are quite confident that we'll achieve the 2.1 billion. And you remember that during the IR day, I mentioned to you this 0.3 billion savings coming from leaner central functions, which makes us even more confident that we'll achieve this 2.1 billion. Let's move to the balance sheet. And we are managing in our general account 575 billion euros. 82% are managed in fixed income. Nothing very different here. You can notice that we still have a duration which is pretty long, 8.2 years. What will, I believe, interest you is the yield on assets. It went down by 20 basis points in life. 15 basis points in non-life, and the reinvestment yield has been 2.1% in 17. Let's move to the investment margin, and here you can notice that on in-force we have an average guaranteed rate of 1.8%, on new business close to 0.3, so we have some flexibility. This flexibility translates into the investment margin because the investment margin goes down from 73 basis points to 69. I just told you that investment income went dropped by 20 basis points, so meaning that we had some latitude and flexibility in order to decrease the remuneration to our policyholders. You can notice here that we are at 69 versus 65 to 75 basis points guidance that we shared with you when we presented our Ambition 2020 plan. On the P&C yield, minus 12 basis points. I'm sorry, I mentioned to you minus 15, it's minus 12. Shareholders' equity, so it's slightly down from 70.6 to 69.6. On the right, you have all the moving elements, and adjusted ROE, as mentioned by Thomas, went up from 13.5 to 14.5%. Solvency II ratio, quite strong. It moved from 197 to 205. On the right, you have the sensitivity analysis, and operating return was 23 points, including 4 points of positive operating variance this year, meaning that it doesn't change. We shared with you that we were close to 20, excluding this operating variance, we would have been at 19 points. We have the dividends, we have the market impacts, which was positive, and keep in mind that we decreased our sub-debt by 1.2 billion, and we had roughly 1 billion of buyback in order to offset the dilutive effect of the of the benefits of the stock options and free shares, performance shares. Strong cash flow generation. It's a move from 6.2 to 6.3 billion and 78% of remittance ratio, which is within the target of 75 to 85. So I'll move to, I'll hand over to Thomas for the conclusion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gérald. As you have seen, the year 2017 has been a year of very strong earnings. And we've always said when we speak about the dividend, a dividend increase needs to be justified by very strong earnings. The board has taken the decision to increase the dividend in a very attractive way. All of these results, as you have seen, are really embedded in all geographies across all lines of business. And we have really implemented what we said, a clear and decisive focus on lines of business that are growing, that are more profitable, and that's the most important, are the closest to the customer, health, protection, and commercial line P&C. This is the driver of our results. All of this has happened and will happen on the basis of an extremely strong balance sheet, where we have again shown that we have improved our Solvency II position by 8 points to 205, which is also the motor of a very strong cash generation with 3.6 billion. And we have continued our journey in the innovation. We have implemented many innovations. I have shown you a few ones in health, which I'm very proud about. Acquisition of Maestro, movement into telemedicine with great success, and also a very clear and strong and decisive act when it comes to our investment policy as a sustainable actor of society. Thank you very much for your attention, and we will now go over to your questions. As Andrew said at the very beginning, we are starting with the questions in the room, and we'll then see if there are questions in the webcast. Let's start with Nick.
Nick Holmes at SocGen. I had a couple of questions on health insurance. Firstly, can you tell us more about your plans to grow the health business? I mean, Maestro is obviously a very interesting acquisition, but it's relatively small. I mean, what sort of appetite do you have? Geographically, where would you focus on things like that? And then secondly, on health, just out of curiosity, do you see it as more P&C or life insurance? You're recategorizing a lot of your business. Just wondered what your thoughts were on that. And then just one very quick additional question, which is how much has the recent volatility in markets hurt your unit-linked growth, which of course has been so strong? Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. So I suggest that I'll take the first two questions and Gérald takes the third one. And while Gérald is looking up the effect, I can answer the first two questions. Your first one was around growth in health. Thinking back, we have 6 countries where we are very strong in health, one of them being in the UK. Our aim is to really gain market share in these countries and grow our health franchise with very innovative products. When you start in the UK, we have been gaining market share as the number 2 in the market because we are very, very innovative and very close to the customer with a lot of innovation. If you go to Germany, which is another stronghold, We have been gaining market share and climbing up the ladder. And you can look at this for all these six geographies. The key is, how can we grow with our customer base? How can we grow with services around our customer base? And if you look into Jacques de Peretti's business in France, they are already a strong leader in health. The fact that they have added wellness and telemedicine into their corporate offering has increased the retention and has also increased their chances of winning business. So there's a very strong focus in those six countries. Everywhere else where we are not strong yet, there is a growth focus on health. If you are in Nigeria, or you are in Indonesia, or you are in Thailand, or you are in China, or you are in Mexico, people will always talk to you at AXA about a focus in health, always with the question, how can we grow in the base coverage, but also how can we grow in the services around it? And the services question in Mexico is a very different one as an answer to the one that it is in Nigeria, where you have no medical infrastructure or insufficient medical infrastructure. Your second question was around which type of business. And we have obviously individual business, group business, P&C, and lifelike. My preference is to grow more in the individual business, to grow more in the P&C-like business, because if you look at the target segments and target lines of business that we have chosen, health, protection, and the P&C commercial, this is basically all insurance risk and a very P&C-minded look at insurance, because protection, at the end of the day, is the P&C part of the life business. Gérald.
Yeah, your question about the recent volatility in unit-linked growth. No, we didn't suffer so much from this volatility. I remind you that we had a quite good start in France, and Jacques could comment on this. We have a good momentum in the U.S., and you know that France and the U.S. are the main countries for unit-linked. Keep in mind as well that if you take the example of France, we don't sell exclusively equity products. So we have structured products, we have different kind of products which which smooth the performance, making that in the end we don't suffer too much from this volatility. Clearly, I remind you that in France we have 40% of our individual revenues for individual savings, which are in unit linked, and this is not something which is declining, not at all.
Let's stay there and go this way. I think, Andy, you are the next one.
Thank you. It's Andy Sinclair from BofA Merrill Lynch. Three questions, please. Firstly, jumping to slide B62, if we can. I was just looking at the comments on the US cash remittance there and just wondered if you could give us any update on what that means for the pre-IPO transactions. Secondly, just wondered if you could quantify your net M&A budget that's unspent over the last couple of years, given that you've done quite a few disposals as well as relatively few acquisitions, and when do you really feel you're sitting on too much? And third, just wondered if you can give us any guidance on the outlook for the US tax rate. Thanks.
Good. So I suggest, Gérald, you take the first question and the third one, and I'll give a go at the second one.
Okay. So starting first with Andy, with page 62, B62. So out of the 4.9 billion, we have 0.8 billion, roughly, coming from the US. That means that we have injected 0.8 billion in the US, but the equity part, that means that in order to reinforce the equity, we initially told you during previous meetings that it would amount to 1 billion, and it would be much smaller, it's 0.3. And the rest, the 0.6, will be repaid in 18. So, meaning that the impact of the recapitalization of the US is smaller than what we could expect a few months ago. US tax rate. as far as the US tax rate is concerned, will benefit. I would say, I mentioned in my presentation the one-off effect on the net income. So this being said, this is a one-off effect due to the fact that we have a DTL position under IFRS, and moving from 35 to 21% is a good guy. At the same time, going forward, we can expect to have to benefit from this lower tax rate. This benefit, I would say, it's not exa- it cannot be so precise because it's a bit complex, but let's say that it could be north from 50 million. North from 50 million, 50 million euros.
Okay, thanks.
On the second question on M&A, in the Ambition 2020, we have stated that we have a yearly net M&A budget of 1 billion, which should result also in a 1% underlying earnings per share increase. When you look over the years, you are absolutely right. We have done some smaller disposals. We have also invested some money. I mean, if you look, we have bought Maestro Health. We have done some share buybacks on the dilution side. Last year, we did a little bit more. And we have, hopefully, an event coming up that will give us more means to redeploy capital, which is the US IPO. Our policy on M&A remains unchanged. If we have the means and if we see interesting and attractive objects and investment opportunities, they will only be looked at in the focus areas health, protection, and commercial line P&C in our focus geographies, the 10 big markets and the 6 high growth markets. That is unchanged.
Sorry, just can you give us a figure for what's left then of the net M&A budget?
You can. Gerald, do you have a figure?
Give me a few seconds and I will give you a precise figure.
Sure.
Good. We'll come back to your question in a minute.
Yeah. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Let's continue with James.
It's James Shuck from Citi here. I had three questions, please. Firstly, in terms of capital allocation within the group, you've changed the disclosure somewhat and you're focusing much more on capital efficiency. I'd like to get some insight into what the regional return on capital employed is, where there are underperforming areas and what your actual process is for allocating or freeing up capital within the group. And also kind of within that, if you're able to give any indication of what the capital is that actually is residing within the smaller entities that you identified at the Investor Day, the 26 or so that are there. Secondly, the growth outlook, so kind of 6 or 7% of EPS growth is the target, which you're kind of well on track for doing. I kind of look at France and Europe ex-France, and they're growing at more like 2 or 3%, and they had a bit of a boost from fee income from higher markets. I would have expected France to be growing a little bit quicker than that. I appreciate it's a competitive market, but it's the digital poster child for the group. Do you expect it to be growing at the kind of group levels? Do you expect Europe to be matching those group levels? And if so, when can we expect that acceleration to come through? And then my final question was just on the operating variances within the AFR, because the operating variances have been driven largely by a positive revision to the best estimate liabilities over IFRS, which is mainly driven by Switzerland, UK, Italy and Spain. I'd be interested to know what the drivers of that were and why we haven't actually seen it come through in the IFRS PYD.
So I suggest, Gerald, I will take the first two questions and you'll do the third one. When it comes to the capital allocation, so we have a very clear framework of how we allocate our capital and also how we manage the companies. And essentially what we do is we look at every entity, how their return on equity is. Is it, first of all, above the capital costs? And then is it returning the way we want to return? And this is also then split by line of business. And that is how we manage the entities. There is a CEO dialogue with all entities every half year, where we basically have a look at these numbers and have asked those entities to give us a clear idea and clear measures of how to improve the return on equity. The new organizational model, which is called Freedom in Boundaries, where we have a lot of empowerment locally, but where we have, on the one hand, a very clear competence in the center for allocating the capital and also for allocating the investment means. This enables us today to really give the capital where we have sufficient returns, above clearly our capital cost, and in decent markets where we are very happy with the returns. And that also will then make the decision easier of where do we withdraw from certain business and where do we also sell entities or change our mind. This has really helped us to be extremely disciplined. And when you look at the results, this is mainly driven by drilling down onto each entity, into each line of business, and managing them in a way that you can either get out of the misery of underperforming, or we need to find a better owner for the business. And this is how we manage this on a very consistent basis. The international markets, yes, there are many markets, but there's not that much capital in it. If I remember correctly, Gerald, I think it was 4 billion that is in the international markets. But we must not get or misconclude from international equals for sale. Again, international, we said, those are the markets of tomorrow. The majority of these markets will be kept, but they will be managed in a different way, which is more in a private equity-like style. And then we obviously have some markets in there that will be sold, where we reduce our footprint. And mentioned earlier, you've seen one example yesterday of Azerbaijan. Your second question was on Europe and France. France, to my mind, has really delivered an excellent result, and we often forget what the year 2017 has looked like in France. When you think about the year 2017, all you think about is Emmanuel Macron. But when you think about what happened before May, we have forgotten the political turmoil, we have forgotten the uncertainty, and we have forgotten that there was no political clarity, which has caused France to be in a very difficult and miserable situation in the first half of 2017. And given this situation, and also given the fact that the competition between the traditional insurers and the bank insurers assures, in particular in the area of the PNC retail business, after the implementation of Loi Hamon, has significantly increased. I personally believe that the results that AXA France has shown as a market leader gaining market share are very, very good results. When you look further into Europe, it is true that I would have loved to see some more growth in some countries. The UK has done a fantastic job in dealing with a very difficult situation of Ogden at the beginning of the year and managing very well through the cycle. If you look at the benchmarks of the UK insurer with AXA, we should be extremely proud of what we have achieved, both in terms of growth and in terms of profitability. Belgium has delivered a fantastic turnaround case and is back on the growth track. Where I would love to see a bit more growth is clearly in Germany on the life side, and is clearly in Switzerland on the life side. If you look at the PNC side in Germany and Switzerland, we should be very happy with the results. So overall, I'm very happy with the results we have seen in Europe. If there's one area where I would like to see more growth, it's on the life side in protection and capital light. But this is clearly something that is on our agenda and that will be addressed with the new responsible Antimo Peretta, who has a great experience of managing a fantastic business in Switzerland. Gerald.
First, going back to your previous questions on the M&A. So in 17, the M&A outflows, net M&A outflows, was minus 0.3 billion. This was on top of the share buybacks that we mentioned before of 1.1 billion. So on a net basis, we could say that it was 1.4 billion to be compared with our 1 billion budget that we announced at the at the IRD. Going back to the other questions relative to operating variance. Indeed, there has been an operating variance adjustment corresponding to, to 4 points of return on AFR. But this is AFR, meaning that it's mark-to-market. So, meaning that any time you have an improvement in your reserve situation and an increase of your excess reserves, then by definition, it's an additional return, which is completely different from IFRS accounts. In IFRS accounts, the reserves and the reserve release has been 1.2%, as I presented it before. But what is quite interesting is to go back to the AFR report, where you will see indeed what you explained about the operating variance. But on top, you will notice that in the reconciliation between the embedded value and the AFR, you have this adjustment from IFRS reserve to the BEL in P&C. And you will see that whereas 1 year ago we had a 5.1 billion adjustment, now we have a positive 5.7 billion adjustment. So we could see that it's a kind of reconciliation. It's in it. That means it's in the AFR. It's confirmed that in the AFR, but it's different from accounting, meaning that these reserves could be released later in the future years.
just to clarify, it looks like the margin over best estimate has actually increased. Because
yes, that's true.
Okay, thank you.
You can hand the mic to John, and then we go this way.
Thank you. John Harkin from Morgan Stanley. Just one question, please. Excuse me. In terms of investment appetite, given the movements we've seen in yields, particularly in the US this year, have you changed your approach to new money in terms of investment allocation by type?
No, we didn't change. I believe that, first of all, it's a good news for us. To have rates in the US and long-term bonds at 2.95, close to 3, is an excellent news. It's a good news because, as you know, we have a gap between assets and liabilities, and our liability duration is higher than our asset duration, and second, because for the new business, it's good. We didn't change it. I believe that the comments that I made 6 months ago about the fact that we are moving towards more illiquid assets, high-quality illiquid assets like ABS, for example, but also commercial real estate loans, illiquid products is still even more relevant. Because in the meantime, for sure, we had a nice increase of the rates, but the spreads, as you know, compressed. And this spread compression is something that we try to fight. And we try to find some alternatives in order to increase our investment income. As I said, we have been investing in fixed income last year in 2017 at an average of 2.1%, and we expect, of course, this year to invest at a higher rate. Maybe it will be 20 basis points higher, something of this magnitude. So it's low. So. Don't consider that. I'm quite optimistic on the fact that we won't see any more very extremely low interest rates. Nevertheless, the recovery will be slow because we have quite a compressed spread.
Thank you very much. Peter Elliott from Kepler Cheuvreux. Three outstanding fairly specific but possibly related questions. I noticed that your average in-force guarantee in Germany has come down from 3.4% at the half year to 2.9% now. I'm just wondering if there's anything in particular you've done there that has caused that. Secondly, on the solvency sensitivities, the sensitivity to interest rates is a lot lower than it was before. Again, just wondering if you could comment a bit further. Finally, on slide that we were just on, I was surprised that the life yield was coming down sort of so much quicker than the P&C yield. I was just wondering if you could just explain that phenomenon. Thank you.
Okay.
Gérald, do you want to tackle the last two questions, and I'll do the first one?
Absolutely. Let's start with the solvency and the sensitivity. The sensitivity is always low. It's always lower when the rates are going up. Keep in mind that we have the U.S. and that we have the U.S. which is in equivalence. So, when rates are going up, we should have our solvency going up. And here we have the effect of the U.S. Nevertheless, we could say that the convexity when rates are going up is a bit lower, and this explains most of the movements. About the life yield and the P&C yield, mostly for one reason. Why 20 basis points in life and why down 12 in P&C? Due to Turkey. Because in Turkey, we are investing at 8%. That's maybe the only country. Yeah, 8%. Yeah. So we are imposed with a 30% drop on our prices in TPL, but nevertheless, we are investing at a higher rate. That's why it helped us. Just to give you an idea, today the contribution to earnings of Turkey was 70 million euros.
On your first question, in Germany, first of all, it's very good news that the guaranteed rate comes down and actually is today below the market average, whereas it used to be above the market average. The reason for it is threefold. First of all, we have really focused our new business sales on businesses with very low guarantee, and it follows exactly what you've seen on the one slide that Gerald has shown earlier with the spread. The guarantee in the new business is very close to zero. So the dilution, I would say, of the in-force brings the overall guarantee down. The second point is you had, at a time in Germany, still benefiting life insurance contracts that are now running off. This is one part why the guarantee has come down. And then there is a third element, which obviously we have done across the whole group, but particularly also in Germany, is to work significantly on the in-force and really to see how do we bring the guarantee down, because there are ways of bringing it down, and how can we also make sure that if people need cash, we can accommodate their wish. But overall, we shouldn't be complaining about these numbers.
Just on the new business point, I mean, the average guarantee you're showing there is still 0.9, but is it the mix rather than the guarantee on traditional? Or the new business guarantee you're showing there is still 0.9, that which is what it was before.
Yeah, but you have to see. So in Germany, there is a particular situation. You have new business and new business. So you have the so-called dynamic, which is I have concluded a contract in 1950, and every year there is an automatic increase of